Okay, so Bershus, Harav Miller and Rav Bednarsh and distinguished Rabbanim guests who have come for the annual Yortzeit Shir, it's always a special schus, particularly in the presence of my mother, to pay tribute to the memory of my father, Abi Mori Tzvi Ben Ephraim HaKohen, on the occasion of his Yortzeit, which is on Chof Ches Tammuz, coming up in the next few days. And towards the end of this year, I'll say a few more words about my father's Zichrono Livracha, but I wanted to get into the main gist of the presentation of the Shir, just to make sure that we cover the territory. The title of the Shir is, Are You Ready for a Prusbel? And the reason for the title is because as we enter into the summer months, so we have all kinds of plans and expectations for the summer, but this summer is unlike most other summers, because towards the end of the summer, as we approach Rosh Hashanah, during Chodesh Elul, actually towards the end of Chodesh Elul, there's a practice at the conclusion of the Shemitah year, which we are in right now, to execute a document known as a prusbel. And therefore, the title is just a reminder that we have to be ready not only for the summer, but you have to be ready for a prusbel. And the literary and cultural references I'll leave to your imagination, v'mei v'nyavin. Now, before you get to a discussion about prusbel, we have to first discuss what the prusbel is necessary for. And that is the mitzvah of Shemitas Ksofim. What is the mitzvah of Shemitas Ksofim? Well, we know that the Shemitah year is a year in which we leave the land fallow. We're supposed to, b'shabsa ha'aretz, cause the land of Eretz Yisrael to rest. However, the Gemara tells us, based on Psukim in the Torah, in Parashas Re'eh, there's another aspect to a Shemitah as well. That is, if you look here in Source 3, the Gemara in Gittin, on Daf Lamed Vav Amud Aleph, Rebbe Omer, V'zeh Dvar HaShemitah Shemot. We're told this is the word, the thing of the Shemitah, that you have to Shemot. Literally, Shemot means you're releasing something. B'shtei Shemitot HaKatuv Medaber. There are two different types of releases. When it comes to the land lying fallow, so we call that Shvius. These are the laws of the seventh year. The laws of Shemitah, of releasing, refer to something else. Bisman she'atah mishamet karka, when there is a release of land, atah mishamet ksofim, then you release money. Bisman she'atah mishamet karka, when you're not releasing land, i'atah mishamet ksofim, then there is no mitzvah, at least from the Torah, of Shemitas ksofim. Release of land is generally understood by the Tosfos and by most Mephorshim, not referring to leaving the land fallow on the Shemitah year. It's referring to the release of land if a person had an ancestral field that they had acquired during the Yovel cycle. It has to be returned on the Yovel year. So what the Gemara is really saying is that Shemitas Ksofim is dependent upon the observance of Yovel. When you observe Yovel and you're returning fields to the original owner on the Yovel year, which is something that's only observed on the Yovel year, then you observe Shemitas Ksofim. What's Shemitas Ksofim? That's a release of debts, of loans. That if somebody extended loans to a borrower, the borrower has not repaid before the end of the Shemitah year, then that loan becomes canceled. It has to be released by the lender. That is the halacha of Shemitas Ksofim. And since nowadays we don't have Yovel anymore, Yovel is no longer observed, so really, according to Torah law, we would not have this release or cancellation of debts. V'takinu rabbanon de teshamet zecha l'shvius. So therefore the rabbis came along and they made a special takana. This is a din d'banan nowadays, as is generally understood from the Gemara, based on this opinion of Rebbe. That's how the Rambam paskins. That's how the Shulchan Aruch paskins, that the release of debts is practiced, but it's only practiced on a rabbinical level. Now, there happens to be at least one opinion in the Rishonim, that of the Bala Iter, that we don't hold like Rebbe, and Shmitas Ksafim is totally independent of the observance of Yovel, and it would even be required to Araisa nowadays. It still would be a Torah obligation, but that opinion is not even brought in Shulchan Aruch. There's another opinion that's brought by the Raman, Simon Samach Zayin and Choshen Mishpat, that says that, in fact, nowadays, the observance of Shemitah's Ksafim is not even Durabanan. It's not even required according to rabbinic law. Maybe, as the Me'ili learns, the Gemara was only talking about in Israel or in those lands that are immediately adjacent to Eretz Yisrael, where one would have to observe it according to rabbinic law. Maybe it was only during the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara that it was observed according to rabbinic law, because there was still established Batei Din in Eretz Yisrael. But nowadays, it's not even required according to rabbinic law, according to any opinions. And the Rama mentions that this is why, in many communities, this was not practiced at all. The whole idea of cancellation of debts at the end of the Shemitah year, for many generations, in many communities, was not practiced at all. And in fact, the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, when he discovered that this practice had fallen into disuse, was extremely upset. He cried out, Kekruchia. He yelled and screamed against the abandonment of this practice and tried very hard to revive it. And Baruch Hashem, for the most part, it has been revived, at least in recent generations, according to the Psak of the Shulchan Aruch. Now, it's important to bear in mind as well that this particular observance only kicks in at the end of the Shemitah year. How do we know that it only kicks in at the end of the Shemitah year? So the Sifrei learns this from the juxtaposition of the Pasuk here with respect to cancellation of debts, where it says, Miketz, if you look in source 1, Miketz Sheva Shanim Taseh Shemitah, says that the Miketz, which sounds like at the end of the 7 years the Shemitah will be performed, and it also says with respect to the mitzvah of Hakel, of gathering together all of the people in the nation when the king reads from the Sefer Torah, the same terminology, Miketz Sheva Shanim B'moed Shnas HaShemitah B'Chag HaSukkos. So from this, the Gemara in Erchin, on Daf Chof Ches Amud Beis, derives that just like, I know that some of you are learning Erchin, that just like the mitzvah of Hakel is only at the conclusion of the Shemitah year, it will be observed, at least in imitation fashion, here in Yerushalayim, this upcoming Sukkot, so too, the cancellation of debts is only at the conclusion of the Shemitah year. There happens to be an outlying shita, that of the Rosh as well, who holds that already one is not allowed to aggressively go after collecting their debts at the end of the 6th year and beginning of the Shemitah year, and it's only the cancellation of debt that kicks in at the end of the 7th year, but one is already not allowed to affirmatively try to collect their obligation at the beginning of the Shemitah year. That's the violation of Lo Yigosis Re'eu, that you're not allowed to solicit funds from the borrower already at the beginning of the Shemitah year. But it's generally assumed, not like the opinion of the Rosh, although there are some who are stringent, as we will see, for that opinion as well. So, before then, we go any further, it's important to explain what Shemitas Ksafim is not. What does the cancellation of debts not represent? Well, one thing it does not represent is a statute of limitations. It's a question as to whether in halakha there is a concept of a statute of limitations, that if you have a claim, that the claim becomes canceled automatically after a period of time, based on simply the lapse of asserting your claim. there's such a concept in secular law. Do we have such a concept in halacha? So some want to say, oh, we do, because we have every 7 years a cancellation of debts. But a statute of limitations would be more along the lines of that when a person had a claim that began at a certain point in time, we'd say the clock starts ticking, and after 6 years, the claim is automatically lapsed. However, here, even if a person would extend the loan on the very last day and the very last hour of the Shemitah year so that the loan was only in existence for 10 minutes, it would be canceled. And it's hard to say that would be in the realm of statute of limitations. So it's clearly something else. It's also not a manifestation of bankruptcy law, according to halacha. Some have said, oh, we see that halacha recognizes the notion of bankruptcy because we allow a person to have a fresh start after 7 years. The problem with that argument is that we allow this fresh start even if the lender is the one who's very, very needy and out of funds, and the borrower is a multi-billionaire. We still say that the debt is canceled and the borrower doesn't have to pay the lender. So this is clearly not a manifestation of bankruptcy law either. However, there is one aspect of Shemitah's Ksafim that is cited in connection with the Jewish law attitude towards bankruptcy, and that is the Mishnah. If you look at a source number something or other, you look at the there's a Mishnah in Masechet Shviyos that says that in the event that a loan has been canceled, that does not mean that we discourage the borrower, source number 12, from ever returning the loan, but rather we say Hamaksir Cho B'Shviyos Ruach Chachamim Nocha Mimenu, that it's still considered to be the ethical thing to do, despite the fact that the loan has been canceled by the end of the Shemitah year, and there is no obligation anymore on the part of the borrower to pay back the loan. That's the idea of Shamot, that it has been, the loan obligation has been released. The lender is not allowed to solicit the funds. That's Lo Yigos Es Reyehu. Nonetheless, it's still considered to be praiseworthy and proper for the person who borrowed the money to repay the money. It's just that they don't repay the money as repayment of a debt, but rather they give it as what we call a matana. It's a gift. They are appreciative that they received this loan. It's true the loan was canceled, but because they received the benefit, therefore they're going to give a gift. Therefore, that's why the Mishnah says, "Amak sicho b'shvius ruach chachamim nocha mimenu." That's considered to be something which the rabbis look upon with favor. It's something which is encouraged. And in fact, there's a whole ritual that's supposed to be performed where the borrower comes to the lender after the Shemitah year and says, here is the money that I owe you. And the lender is supposed to say, Shamotani, Meshametani. But your loan had been released, and therefore I am just letting you know that the loan is released. The reason why it's verbalized is because the Torah says, "Vezed devar hashmitah." This is the word, these are the words of Shemitah, that it's supposed to be verbalized by the lender. It doesn't mean, the way that most Rishonim understand it, that this is a ritual that needs to be performed per se, in order for the loan to be cancelled. There's a machlokis as to whether the cancellation is afkata demalka, whether it's something that happens automatically, or whether the loan remains outstanding until such time as the lender actually says these words, Mishamet Ani. The only one who's of the opinion that the loan remains payable and outstanding until the articulation of Mishamet Ani is the Sefer Yerayim, and pretty much everybody else argues, the Or Zarua, the Mordechai, all disagree with the Sefer Yerayim, and they say the Minchas Chinuch as well. They say that it is Afkata Demalka. The loan is automatically canceled. The mitzvah, in fact,
of the cancellation of loan is performed. As soon as the Shemitah year has ended and the loan has been canceled, but additionally, when the borrower does come and says, I want to pay you, the lender at that point in time has an additional obligation. It's sort of an extension of this idea of the cancellation of debt, where the lender says, Mishametani, where he verbalizes the notion that the loan is canceled, and then the borrower is supposed to say, Afa Pikain, nonetheless, I want to pay you. But it's an Afa Pikain, then nonetheless, I want to pay you in the form of a matana. In fact, Rav Elyashiv says, and this is the Pashut Pshat, this is the simple understanding of how it works, that there's a difference in terms of how the funds are treated when the borrower pays under these circumstances. If the borrower would be repaying a debt, so then a person wouldn't have to pay Maaser Ksavim. They wouldn't have to take out, they wouldn't have to pay a charity percentage from this money, because it wouldn't be income. It would simply be repayment of a debt. However, Rav Elyashiv Zatzal pointed out that in the context of Shemitas Ksavim, since this money, when it is being paid as a matana, therefore one would have to allocate Maaser Ksavim, they would have to allocate charity money for the receipt of this amount that they receive from the borrower in this context. So some poskim point out that this should certainly be the attitude that one has whenever one borrows money, even if that money ends up being discharged. So there's a whole machlokis whether halakha recognizes selah bankruptcy law based on principles of dina de machusadina, of the law of the land. Sometimes, the Rama writes in Choshen Mishpat Shim and Simen Shin Samach Tes, sometimes we do recognize the law of the land when it is in the monetary realm and it's for purposes of broad economic regulation. So it could be bankruptcy law would be recognized. Rav Moshe Feinstein seems to have a tshuva in which, at least to some degree, he says that Dina de Machusadina is applicable to bankruptcy law. But even if Dina de Machusa dictates that Halakha would recognize secular bankruptcy law so that the debts of somebody who declared bankruptcy would be discharged, Poskim point out that we should still apply this principle of the notion that kol ha-machzir es chovo, anybody who pays back even that which they're not obligated to repay, because they received a favor, they received a loan originally from the lender, ruach hachamim nocha mimenu, it's considered to be the proper and ethical thing to do. Yes?
Is motive important? So for instance, if I return, because I might want to borrow from the person again in the future, what would it make any difference?
As long as you're doing the right thing, I don't know that it would be mitigated by the fact that you're human and you might have these thoughts in the deep recesses of your mind. However, the Gemara indicates that at least in the context of Shemitah's Ksafim, it should be made clear, if not explicitly, at least implicitly, that what's being returned is not in the context of returning the debt, as a debt per se, but rather as a matana. So those are things that Shemitas Ksafim are not. It's not really a statute of limitations. It's not really bankruptcy law. So what is a Shemitas Ksafim? The Netziv has a very interesting comment in his parish to the Torah. The Netziv of Naftali Tzvi Berlin says that the reasoning behind the Shemitas Ksafim is precisely because during the Shemitah year, people left their lands fallow, so normally when it came to paying back a debt, people would be able to rely on the crops that were generated by their fields in order to generate income to repay their debts. But during the Shemitah year, since they do not have crops that are being generated, since the land is being left fallow, therefore the borrowers will have less money, and that's why specifically during this year, the Torah gives a dispensation that a person would be discharged from their debts. Now, this is an explanation that works well for anybody who's living in Eretz Yisrael, but the Gemara in Kiddushin on Daf Lamed Ches says that we learn from the Pasuk, Ki Karash Mita La Hashem, that it simply says there's a Shemitah, there's a release of debts to God. It's not something which is tied to the land per se, that it, this is something which is applicable b'chol makom. It's applicable wherever you live. So if it's applicable wherever you live, so we have to give some more reasoning just to the general concept of Shemitah's Ksafim, although from the Netziv, we can understand why it would be why it would be applied specifically during the end of the Shemitah year, in which the lands are being left fallow. So the Sefer HaChinuch says that it's to teach us certain basic ethical principles. One of Nedivas Lev, of generosity, that when you give out money, this is a righteous thing to do, that Hashem gives you the money, so that you should extend it to other people, and you shouldn't feel that you have a right to that money per se. And therefore, this underscores the fact that it's not your money, that you're entitled to exact it from the borrower, that there's at least one period of time in which you're reminded you can't always ask for the money back. Secondly, it reinforces the notion of bitachon, that you have to have faith in the Kaddish Baruch Hu, that whatever you're meant to have, you're going to have, even if you occasionally make loans and you're told you can't collect them in return. That it's not based on your savvy business dealing that you have what you need in this world. It's based on a Kaddish Baruch Hu giving you what you have. And thirdly, it's to reinforce the notion of Isser Gezela. You're not allowed to steal from people. If a Kaddish Baruch Hu says that even that which you're entitled to, you're not always allowed to insist on getting back, then Kol Shekein Kavachomer, how much more so are you not allowed to cheat and swindle and steal from people? So all of these are the messages of Shemitah's Ksafim. So we mentioned that there are these two aspects. Number one, that the loan is canceled. Number two, lo tigos, that the lender is not allowed to proactively solicit repayment of the loan from the borrower. But there's also a third component. And the third component, if you look in source number two, is a separate mitzvah that says, "Hishamer l'cha penyeya davar im levavcha v'liyal lemor," that somebody who's a potential lender shouldn't have a bad thought in his heart, in which he would say, "Hey, you know what? Karvash nasa shevash nasa shmita. This the end of the seventh year is coming up. V'ra'in cha b'achicha evyon, and therefore I'm not going to extend the loan." Because even to a poor person, because I'm afraid that I won't be able to collect this loan, since it will be canceled at the end of the seventh year. And that will lead to the person committing a sin. So this third component might actually, according to some Mefarshim, be in existence even when the observance of Shemitah's Ksafim is only rabbinical in nature. Therefore, this might be a Torah prohibition even in our times, even when we are only observing Shemitah's Ksafim on a rabbinical level. This is the lead-in for the discussion about Prizbul. How is it the lead-in for the discussion about Prizbul? Because if you look at discussion in the Gemara, this is in source number three. What was the background as to what the whole idea of Prizbul is? Okay, so just as one additional important source before we read this Gemara, in source number three about the establishment of a Prizbul, there's a Mishnah in Maseches Shviyas that says, this is a Mishnah in Maseches Shviyas that says that if somebody is most shtarosav lebezdin einan mishamtin, that's in source number six. If a person who's a lender has documents of indebtedness, their IOUs, their loan promissory notes, and they take those promissory notes and hand over those promissory notes to the Bezdin, to a rabbinical court, so then the loans do not become canceled. Why do the loans not become canceled? So the Sifrei says, this is based on the Pasuk in Devarim, in the source number one, "Vashir yiyeh l'cha esachicha tashmet yadecha," that what type of loan gets canceled? That which is in your hands, that gets canceled. below amosir shtarosa of the basin, but not if it's not in your hands, but it has been transmitted to basin, then it's no longer in your hands. It's not no longer considered to be a loan which is being collected by the lender himself or herself, but rather this is now a loan which is in the hands of Bezdin. Either this is because of the Gzeiras HaKasuv, of what the Torah decrees, that it has to be in the hands of the lender, and now it's in the hands of the Bezdin, and therefore it's not subject to the prohibition. Or as the Ritva explains, that what's the whole problem with collecting the loan? That you're violating lo yigosis reyehu, that you're not allowed to go after your colleague, your friend, to collect the loan. But this, if once it's in the hands of the Bezdin, since Bezdin has enforcement power, hareze nigos viomed, this is considered as if it's basically already collected. Because as we know, Bezdin is all-powerful, and once something is in the domain of a Bezdin, then it's as good as already enforced. And therefore, whatever is being collected afterwards is essentially a mere formality. Because once it's in the hands of Bezdin, then everybody can rest secure that they know that it's going to be taken care of efficiently. So, therefore, that is why Moser Shtarosev is not a problem. Now, is this a Torah law, or is this a rabbinical law? So, this seems to be a potential disagreement between Rashi and Tosfos in Makos on Adaf Gimel Amud Beis, at sources 7 and 8 in the materials. Rashi seems to feel that Moser Shtarosev LeBezdin is all part of the rabbinical decree of Prusbul that we're about to discuss, and Tosfos seems to be of the opinion that they are two separate decrees, because the Mishnayos and Shviyas talk about Moser Shtarosev and then talk about Prusbul, indicating Moser Shtarosev giving over one's promissory notes works on a Torah level, and whatever Hillel did with respect to Prusbul is something which itself is only on a Drabanan level, but is not exactly the same thing. So with that introduction, what exactly is this Prusbul business that we're talking about? So you look at source number 3. The Mishnah in Gittin talks about different things that were done because of Tikkun Olam. They were done to make the world a better place, so that everybody could just kind of sing with their guitars about how lovely and groovy things are in this world. So, as we know, that's what Tikkun Olam is all about, right? So, one of the Tikkun Olam things was that Hillel established a Prusbul in order to prevent this problem of lenders violating this halakha, this mitzvah of refusing to make loans, to extend loans during the Shemitah year out of fear that the loans would be canceled. So tonight the Hasam, the Gemara quotes the Mishnah, Prusbul eino mishamik. If there's a Prusbul, the loan is not canceled. This is one of the things that Hillel HaZaken lived during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. This is one of the Tanaim. So he established this Prusbul. Shirah Sa'am Shinimnu Malahabal Zed Zeh. He saw that the people were not extending loans to each other, and they were violating that which it says in the Torah. As we read, Amad v'hiskin Prusbul, so he established the Prusbul. What's the Prusbul? Zeh gufo shel Prusbul. So the Prusbul says, Mosrei, it's a document, and it says, Mosreini lachem ploni dayanim shemamakom ploni. I am handing over to you the dayanim in this particular location, that whatever debt I have that is owed to me by a borrower, it could be a collection of borrowers, that I will be allowed to collect whenever I want, and the dayanim sign underneath, or the witnesses sign underneath. And that is the entirety of the Prusbul. So Tosfos points out this is something which is separate than Moser Shtarosev of LeBezdin. But how is it separate? Sounds very similar. It's giving over the debts to the Bezdin. What did Hillel introduce that was not automatically included in the notion of handing over one's debts to Beis Din? So the Ramban explains that Hillel expanded upon this concept in two important ways. One, Hillel said you don't have to actually take your promissory notes and physically hand them to the Beis Din. You can just say to the Beis Din, those promissory notes that I have are going to you wherever they happen to be located. Secondly, let's say that the loan is not evidenced by a promissory note. There's such a thing as a milval peh. I just give you some money as a loan and we don't write it up in a promissory note. Many loans and many types of debts that are the poskim talk about debts that are converted into loans. You start off with a debt. It could be a shopkeeper a debt. Could be a service that was provided and you have a debt. And a bill is sent to you. Once the bill is sent to you, so then it's converted into a loan. So not always are these different types of indebtedness evidenced by shtaros. They're not always in the form of a document that can be handed over to the Beis Din for collection purposes. And Hillel said, regardless of the nature of the debt, and regardless of whether you have a document or not, or handing over the document or not, you have the ability to place the debt in the hands, constructively place the debt in the domain of the Beis Din, so that now Shemitah is not going to cancel the debt. So now it's that we've spoken about what Shemitah's Ksafim is not, it's important to talk about what Prusbul is not. We see that Prusbul is modeled very, very clearly upon this idea of Motzei Shtaros of the Beis Din. According to Rashi, it's exactly the same thing. Even according to Tosfos, it's really an extension of this. And it's clearly designed for purposes of avoiding a Torah prohibition, so that it's a takana that Hillel made in order to comply as opposed to controvert Torah law, since Torah law says we have to make sure that the lenders will extend their loans even during the Shemitah year. This is something which Hillel assured. And thirdly, and also very importantly, the Rambam says, and this is how we generally assume, Prusbul only works nowadays when Shemitah is only Derabanan. That's what the Gemara in Gittin and Daf Lamed Vav and Aleph says. How is it that Hillel could come along and do something according to Torah law? The loan would have been canceled, and now Hillel comes along. So Abaye says, "B'shvius b'zman hazeh." We're talking about only during nowadays when Shemitah is observed on a Rabbanan level, where it's only rabbinic, so therefore he can make this rabbinic enactment. So anybody who has wanted to distort, pervert, or manipulate the halakha, especially in non-orthodox circles, what's the first thing they always cite? Prusbul! Prusbul! Look, Hillel did the Prusbul, and therefore we can be Mechal Shabbos. Hillel did the Prusbul, and therefore we can break down all of the traditions of our Mesorah and do whatever we want. So it's simply not true. Hillel's Prusbul was in furtherance of the observance of Torah law, and furthermore, it followed the usual rules that it was a takana that was applicable on a rabbinic level to address a law which is observed rabbinically nowadays. The Ravid happens to be of the opinion that Prusbul works even when Shemitah's Ksafim is d'oraisa. We don't generally assume like the Ravid, but the Ravid is based on a reading of the continuation of the Gemara, which cites Rava as saying that an operative principle is hefker bez than hefker, that since this is something in the monetary realm, so there is more flexibility for the Chachamim in the monetary realm to declare certain money to be ownerless. However, there's an opinion of a famous opinion, to get into a little bit of lumdus, of the Machane Ephraim, that says that hefker bez than hefker only works to declare something ownerless, but not to endow possession to somebody else. So if you look at the context in which Rabbah stated Hefker, Bezdin, and Hefker, it wasn't as a justification of the principle, it was as a justification as to how we could have Shemitah's Ksafim at all nowadays. If on a Torah level there wouldn't be Shemitah's Ksafim, how could the Chachamim have said you could have Shemitah's Ksafim at all? So there, Rabbah said Hefker, Bezdin, and Hefker. The lender would have been entitled to get the money back, but we say he's not entitled to get the money back. However, the idea of Prisbol says, not only does the, are we mafkir the money to say that the borrower loses his money, but we're saying that the borrower has to lose his money and give it to the, and give it to the lender. So, for Shemitah, so for purposes of giving over money to somebody else, so that, says the Machaneh Ephraim, we don't say Hefker Bezdin Hefker, and therefore Rabbah's statement has no relationship to the law of Prisbol, and the only statement that justified Prisbol in the Gemara was that of Abaye, who said it's justified because we're talking about Shvius Bizman Azeh, we're talking about the observance of Shemitah's Ksafim nowadays, which is only Midrabanan. Just parenthetically, at what point in time is Shemitah's Ksafim going to become Daraisa again? So that's when Yovel will be observed. When does Yovel become observed? When all the Jewish people will return to Eretz Yisrael, or the majority of the Jewish people. It could be Rubo Kikulo. So many people are keeping tabs on how close we're getting in Eretz Yisrael for the demographics to be such that the majority of the Jewish people will be living in the land of Israel. We're getting closer and closer.
But the American statistics are impossible from a halakhic point of view.
The American statistics.
Of Jews are impossible.
No, they're assimilating very fast. So, you know, as that population depletes.
The reform report to people with a Jewish father as a Jew. How can you tell how many Jews there are?
Well, it depends how you paskid the halacha. It depends how far you extend the idea of principle. So we don't extend to the degree in which we would say that patrilineal descent can define who is Jewish. So it could be that once we get to that point where Rov Yosheveh Olah, when the majority of Jews are on the land of Israel, this whole thing will have to be reevaluated. But as Rabbi Bednarz could tell you from the Maseches Erechin, it's not as simple as that. It's not only having the majority of Jews back in the land, but it's having every single Shevet in their appropriate place. And since we are not yet at the point where we're identifying every Shevet that people come from and what place they would be in, so we might have a longer time to go until we get to that point in time that we can start observing Yovel again, but we hope that it will be very, very soon. Now, what does the word Prisbol mean? So the word Prisbol, according to the Gemara at source number 10, Gittin Daf Lamed Vavam and Beis, my Prisbol, so I'm of Kista, Prus Buli Ubuti. It's a Prus for the Bulis and the Booties. It sounds almost like a Yale sports song. So what's a Prus for the Buli and the Booty? So that is, a Prus means it's a Takana. It's an enactment for the Buli, for the rich, the bull market, right, the Buli, and for the Booty, and for those who are poor. And therefore, in shorthand, we call it Prisbol. How is it something that's good for those who are rich? It's good for those who are rich because now they're not going to violate the prohibition against refusing to extend loans because they know that they will be able to collect their loans by making a Prisbol. And it's good for the booty, it's good for the poor people because they'll get their booty because they will get the loans that will actually be extended to them by the lenders. Why do we only include bull in the final terminology and not boot? Why do we only call it Prisbol and not Prisbol boot? So the reason is because if a borrower really wanted money, then they could figure out ways that they can get money. Because they could say, I'm going to make a private deal with you. This is the Gemara in Makos. Gemara Makos says that they could agree to a private deal and say, even though Shemitah is going to cancel this loan, between you and me, the halakha actually permits this. This is which is why Prisbol is not so incredibly innovative. The halakha actually permits the borrower to stipulate with the lender, between you and me, I'm going to pay you back anyway. How could he do that? Isn't that what we call masna mashikasu b'Torah? You're making a condition against what is prohibited by the Torah. So the Gemara says that all hinges on the terminology you use. What a difference a letter makes. If you say, Amenash lotish meteni shvius, if the lender says, I'm going to extend the loan to you, and the borrower agrees to this, on condition that Shvius will not cancel the loan, so that's null and void, because Shvius is going to cancel the loan whether you like it or not. As we said, it's afkata demalka. It's something which is just canceled by a Kaddish Baruch Hu. It goes away by itself. But if the lender stipulates, amenas shalotish mitaini, on condition that you're not going to cause me to have to cancel this bashvius during the conclusion of the Shemitah year, so that's considered to be okay. You add the base. Why does the base make such a big difference? Because what the base is saying is that I agree with you as far as Shvius is concerned. Of course the loan will be canceled. However, between you and me, you, the borrower, will agree to pay me anyway that which you, as the Rambam puts it, that which you are not obligated to pay me, you'll take upon yourself a separate obligation. It's considered to be not a repayment of loan obligation, but a separate hischaivus, a separate non-loan obligation that the borrower is taking upon himself or herself. So therefore, that's something that if a borrower really wanted funds, a borrower could do it that way. Or, alternatively, this is a dispute in the Gemara, but according to the way we hold, a borrower could make up with the lender that the due date of the loan will not be before the end of the Shemitah year. It'll be on Tzom Gedalia of the eighth year of the year after Shemitah. That only on Tzom Gedalia on the eighth day after Shemitah will the loan have to be repaid. And if the loan is not due and payable before the end of the Shemitah year, there's nothing to collect. If there's nothing to collect, there's nothing to cancel. And therefore, that type of loan is not canceled. So a borrower could borrow in that fashion as well. However, from a lender's perspective, it could be that a lender would want to have a greater reassurance that they would be able to make a loan that didn't have those terms, and maybe the lender wouldn't even find the borrower who was willing to borrow on those terms. It could be that every borrower would say, no, I want to borrow on terms in which it's only a 30-day loan. The 30 days expire before the end of the Shemitah year. I'm not going to agree to this business of Amanash Lotish Mateni Bashvias that I'll have to pay you back anyway. And therefore, the way in which the lender is able to best protect himself, also, maybe the lender will forget at the time that they make a loan to say Amanash Lotish Mateni Bashvias. So for all of these reasons, Perzbol is considered to be more of a protection for the lender than for the borrower. And actually, the Chidushei Anshei Shem on the Mishnayos and Shvius points out that this whole Perzbol terminology didn't seem to come from the Gemara. There's actually a Greek word, and the Greek word is called Perzbulibuti. Perzbulibuti was a very popular dance in Greek. No, it was Perzbulibuti was the term that was used to describe the Department of Economic Good and Welfare. According to Greek tradition, they had an actual department, and that was what the department was called. So explains the Kedusha Hashem, since there was such a word out there with this etymology, Perzbulibuti, and the Chazal were able to use their own definitions of Perz and Bul in order to mean something that would promote the economic good and welfare according to Halakha. So they borrowed from that well-known term to mean something else, and that's how they came up with the term Perzbol, Torah Umadza, in action. So now that we've explained what Perzbol is, how do you go about executing this Perzbol in front of a Beis Din? So the Perzbol only works for loans that were in existence prior to the execution of the Perzbol. So therefore, it's generally the practice to wait as long as possible towards the end of Elul before the Perzbol is executed, because it's not going to cover loans that are extended or even things that turn into loans. That are, a person's a doctor and they send out a bill and the bill hasn't been paid and they treat the patient 2 days before Rosh Hashanah. Doesn't matter that they did a Perzbol a week earlier. They're not going to be allowed to collect that debt. So, therefore, in order to protect in order for people to protect themselves, the Perzbol is done very often in Erev Rosh Hashanah, where it's done at the latest possible moment. But in front of whom does the Perzbol have to be done? So we said it is a transmission of the indebtedness that is owed to the lender that is given over to the Beis Din. So there happens to be one opinion in the Gemara, Shmuel, that says this has to be the most chashuv of Beis Din in the world. It has to be like Beis Din Desura, Beis Din the Naharda. This has to be like the Beis Din, which is the most prestigious and most prominent Beis Din that you could with the Chachamim who have the authority to confiscate money away from people. So the Aruch HaShulchan writes that in his days it wasn't so prevalent for people to execute prosbuls, and they didn't worry about Shemitah's Ksafim. They relied on those who said, oh, it's not in practice nowadays. He said because they felt no Beis Din was quite of that ilk, that it had the ability to confiscate people's properties. They just did away with it altogether. However, the reality is that the Gemara also says that the rabbis, the Bei Rav Ashi, who just were the yeshiva guys who learned in the Beis Medrash, Masum Milayo LaHadadi, they gave over for the prosbul. They just used whoever was sitting next to them in the Beis Medrash. So it sounds like maybe you don't need the most prominent rabbis who are out there. So this ends up being a little bit of a machlokus. Pretty much everyone agrees you don't need like a Beis Din, the Surin and Hadah, but the Mechaber, the Shulchan Aruch, says you need a Beis Din Chashuv. You need like an important, whoever happens to be the reigning Beis Din in your community, that's who you should use. The Ramah says, well, it's okay to use anybody, but as a practical principle, everyone's in agreement that the best thing, if you can swing it, is to use the Beis Din, which is composed of the most prominent Dayanim, or the most established Beis Din entity, which is in your community. So therefore, we drew up these documents when I was at the Beis Din of America, and we also have such documents. I'm going to get into trouble because I have a president of the Chicago Rabbinical Council here, and I brought you the Beis Din of America form, so I apologize. But we have these different forms of a prosbul, of the prosbul forms where they are, where they establish the names of the Dayanim that would be the Beis Din that you would go to. And there are two different forms of this document. One is where you're just signing the form in front of the judges themselves, and the person would make the declaration, they're giving over their debts, that we have it both Hebrew and in English, and whoever the Dayanim are, you're in the Beis Din office, so whichever three rabbis are there at the Beis Din of America, at the Chicago Rabbinical Council, whatever the Beis Din is, and on that day, you'd fill in the name of the Dayanim, and then the form would be signed by the three judges after the person makes the declaration of the prosbul. Now, there's another form in which the Dayanim, the rabbis, are simply named. They're actually named. And I brought in the form that this is a shir at the Gross Campus of Yeshiva University. So I brought in the form that we drew up to be used by Yeshiva University. It's generally executed by the General Council in connection with the observance of Shemitah for this year, that yeshiva will execute a prosbul form to cover any of the debts which are owed to it, which is a really good idea. And we named the three of the Dayanim, since I drew up the form, I didn't put my own name in it, we named three of the Dayanim who sit at the Beis Din of America for YU to be able to name them. Because one different way, as we read in the Gemara, that a person can execute a prosbul form is they could do it in front of the Dayanim, but if the Dayanim aren't there, let's say the person's not able to walk into the Beis Din office, they do it in front of witnesses and simply state in front of the witnesses that they're giving over their debts to the Beis Din so that they have the ability to collect the debts. This is a little bit of a discussion. What does it mean that it's signed by witnesses? Are those witnesses who are present at the Beis Din, or even if the Beis Din's not there altogether? So this is, if you look at source number 9 says, Rabbi Cheskia b'shem Rabbi Yirmi, this is the Yerushalmi, Rabbi Cheskia b'shem Rabbi Yirmi, b'afilu nisunim b'romi, says that you can do a prosbul even if they're in Rome. Even if what's in Rome? So that's a question. So the Ran says, even if the loan documents are in Rome, because as we mentioned, the whole idea of the prosbul is that the prosbul form allows the debts to be handed over to the Beis Din without the actual promissory notes being handed over to the Beis Din. So even if the promissory notes are in Rome, in a Rome bank account or whatever, and they're not handed over to the Beis Din, so that is good enough. So the Mordechai says, you know what Vafilin Asuna Meromi means? It's not that the loan documents are in Rome, the Dayanim are in Rome. What are the Dayanim doing in Rome? I have no idea. Maybe they were meeting with the Pope already a couple of thousand years ago and we didn't know it. But the Dayanim, according to the Mordechai, somehow, maybe it's the summer, right? They're vacationing in Rome. They're in Rome. So even though the Dayanim are in Rome, and therefore the parties are not able to appear before the Dayanim, nonetheless, the Yerushalmi indicates that it would be permissible to simply hand over the loan obligations to the Dayanim in their absence, and this is the justification of signing a form in front of witnesses. So this has created a lot of discussion. What's the optimal way to do it? So some say, well, it's only the opinion of the Mordechai that says that you can use witnesses, so therefore we should really try to make sure that we go only in front of the judges, and since not everybody can go in front of the judges, it's better to appoint a shliach. It's better to appoint an agent if you can't come in front of the Dayanim, and that agent will represent the person in front of the Dayanim. But even that is subject to dispute, because some say, well, what you're giving over is a declaration. A declaration is called mili. It's words. Not mili lo mimsran l'shliach. Maybe it's not so simple that words can be given over to a shliach, to an agent. So therefore, that's questionable. Others say, well, we want to protect ourselves and do things in the best possible way, so we really want to go in front of the most prestigious Beis Din. Not everybody lives in the vicinity of the CC or the Beis Din of America. Say, we really want the most prestigious Beis Din, but we're not going to get there. So they'll sign a document that says, well, there are three people sitting in the Beis Medrash right now, and okay, you know, those are the best rabbis that we can find. So we'll hand over the debts to these three rabbis, not as witnesses, but as a Beis Din. But then we'll include a clause saying that in the event that this is not good enough, so we hereby are declaring in front of these three rabbis that if they're not good enough, then we are giving over our debts in front of the following prestigious rabbi, the three prestigious rabbis who are the Gedolei Ador, and they mention whoever these three most prestigious rabbis are. So these forms are kind of floating around there. However, it seems to me that you can't go wrong using the terminology and the formulations that are approved in the Shulchan Aruch and by the Ramah, and both the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah approve both the idea of submitting to a Beis Din. Certainly, if it is the established Beis Din in your community, also in the event that you can't come in front of that Beis Din, then they approve of the idea of simply gathering two kosher witnesses and submitting in front of those two kosher witnesses, declaring to them that you are submitting your debts to the following institutional Beis Din that is well respected. And therefore, I think that if you utilize these simple forms, you probably would be okay. Now, the Gemara also says that you can't execute a prusbul unless the borrower has some karka. The borrower has some real estate. Because this way, it's not entirely clear, this way what? This way, you would have something to be able to collect from. The Beis Din would have something to be able to collect from. There are two different explanations given. Rashi says that since prusbul was a takana, it was a special enactment, therefore it was only done in cases where it was a normal sort of loan. And in those days, nobody made loans if they didn't have the security of real estate. Rash and others give a different explanation. They say, you know, you need real estate because this way, when Beis Din has the ability to collect a loan, they have something to collect from. It's considered to be in the hands of Beis Din because they can go after the karka, they can go after the real estate of the borrower. The Chasam Sofer points out that it's not the practice, generally speaking, at least in the standard prusbul form, is based on the formulation in the Gemara, to say explicitly that the borrowers have to have land. They used to have a form which would say explicitly, some people still use this, that the lender is making a kinyan, the lender is lifts up an object like a handkerchief or something and makes a kinyan in which the lender gives over some land to the borrower. So Ksam Sofer says, you know why people don't do this? Because nowadays, when people make a loan, they're not for the most part relying upon collecting from land. Unless it's like a mortgage or something, which might not need a principal altogether. But if it is a standard loan, then it's not something where people are relying upon the collection of land. So therefore, it might not even be necessary to have land. That's very radical. And a lot of the standard Sfarim that collect the laws of Shemitah, Ksafim, don't even quote the Ksam Sofer because it's so radical. It's against the Mishnah. It's against the Mishnah, against the Gemara. So I thought that the explanation is probably as follows: that it's not just that the borrower, it's not that you need for the borrower to have land. Let's say that somebody owes the borrower money, who himself or herself has land. So then that also is considered to be good enough. If A owes B money and B owes C money, it's considered as if A owes C money. So if the borrower owes Shimon owes Reuven money. And Levi owes Reuven money, and Levi has land, so that's good enough for Shimon to be able to rely upon the land that Reuven is entitled to from Levi, if I got the name straight, in order to be able to collect the karka that is owed to the borrower from somebody else who owes money to the borrower. So since nowadays most people have at least some money in the bank, and banks either own land or have mortgages in which they have the right to go after other people who owe the bank money, and those people have land that they've given mortgages to the bank. So nowadays, as long as there's an expectation that a person who has borrowed money has money in the bank, so that automatically would give them the access to karka, so you wouldn't have to worry that there's a possibility that there wouldn't be karka to be able to collect from. So just the last thing that I would mention is that the Ben Ish Chai makes the following recommendation. The Ben Ish Chai says, this is all fine. We've been able to solve the problem that people are not going to run afoul of collecting debts that were canceled by the Shemitah year because we have Prizbal, and we highly recommend that everybody execute a Prizbal so that they won't violate any prohibitions. Great. But what about the notion that the Torah seems to favor this idea that there be some sort of a debt which is canceled? So therefore, the Ben Ish Chai recommends that after one has executed a Prizbal, they make some sort of a small loan to somebody. The example he gives is of a woman who lends a loaf of bread to her neighbor. So that's considered to be a loan because you're not expected to get the same loaf of bread back, right? You'll get back a different loaf of bread. So here, instead of collecting a different loaf of bread because of the cancellation of any loans based on the Shemitah year, so you will forego the repayment of that loaf of bread. And similarly, a person could just make a $2 loan to their friend and have in mind that they won't collect it. It's recommended by others that it really just be canceled and that you not go through this whole ceremony and ritual of the borrower saying, oh, I'm going to pay it back to you anyway, and the lender saying, I'm a shamet ani, because you might mess it up and not do that properly, and therefore just leave it alone. And this way, in addition to executing the principal form, there can also be some sort of an observance of having an actual cancellation of debt, of some sort of a small debt. It's not something which is absolutely required according to halacha if people are afraid that they're not going to do it properly. In fact, when Gavriel Tzinner wrote he wrote an epic work on Shemitah, Ksafim, and Prizbal, and he made this, he quoted this Ben Ish Chai, he said that both of the late Rav Shmuel Vosner and Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach advised him to make it clear that this is not something that he's pushing. It's not something that you should push. It's not absolutely necessary. It's just an Eitzah Tova. Maybe they felt that way because somehow the cancellation is not a required affirmative act. It's an Afkata Demalka. It's Hashem's business. But they say you don't have to push it too much, but it's just a good idea if somebody is able to remember doing this. Okay. I just wanted to conclude with a couple of words of Zikaron in memory of my father. We read in Parshas Matos that there was a about the laws of Nidarim, of what happens when a person takes a neder, lo yachel dvaro, they're not allowed to violate their word. If a woman takes a neder, so if she's a nara, she's a young girl, then her father can be mayfair that neder, he can nullify the vow. So Rav Gedalia Shur, in his Sefer Or Gedalio, points out, he quotes Rabbi Tzadok HaKohen, who says that whenever we have any type of mitzvah or description in the Torah of a particular commandment, of a particular inyan, some type of an action that is described by the Torah that we're supposed to perform. So you have to look at the first time it's introduced in the Torah, and the first time it's introduced, that establishes the tone as to what it's all about. So he says, when it comes to a neder, a vow, the first time that it's introduced in the Torah is when the Torah says, "Vayidar Yaakov neder lemor." Yaakov took a neder, a vow, and he said, "If God is with me, then everything that Eben Azos Asher Samtem Matzivah Yiyeh Beis Elokim, the place where I am standing right now, I shall make into a godly place. I will bring an offering. I will make this into a godly place." So Rav Gedalia Dov Shur says this teaches us that when it comes to vows, even though they're often discouraged by the by Chazal, that it's like you're bringing a bummer, you're bringing an improper altar, you're building an improper altar and bringing a sacrifice on it. That's only if it's not done l'shem shemayim, if it's not done for lofty and for godly reasons. But if you do perform a vow. For l'shem shemayim, you do it like Yaakov Avinu. You do it l'shem shemayim. You do it for the sake of God. So then, that builds a place of kedusha. And he says, now that we're in the 3 weeks period when we read the Parsha Matos, it's meant to remind us that everything that we do, we have to turn our makom. We have to turn our location. We have to turn our circumstances into a place of kedusha, a place of holiness. That we can always go in different directions when we are faced with the challenges of our lives and the circumstances of our lives. That we can go in the direction of Shalol L'Shem Shemayim, in which case it really doesn't have holiness, or we can go in the direction of L'Shem Shemayim that endows things with Kedusha. The most prominent figure that seems to be mentioned in Parashas Matos in connection with the Nedarim of a family member is whom? Is the father. It's a girl who takes a vow, and the father has to decide, is this a vow that I want to maintain, or is this a vow that I want to nullify? And it shows that the prominent place that a father can play in his family's life in terms of defining what is proper, what is improper, what are our bounds, where do we belong, how do we define the space in which we live. And my father, Zichrono Levracha, in terms of the example that he demonstrated in where he chose to live, where he chose to teach. I don't know how many people know this, but he taught at Yeshiva University High School for many years. I believe that he had Rabbi Miller Shlita as a student. And the Avas Yisrael, the love for all Jews that my father demonstrated, especially when he was a town councilman in Muncie, and he had to cater to needs of a very, very broad and complicated constituency, and the ideals to which he devoted his life in terms of building a Holocaust center, and the lessons that he taught the members of his family and everybody around him were all to instill in us a sense of kedusha, a sense of sanctifying our places, and a sense of sanctifying our lives, and sanctifying all of the circumstances in which we would find ourselves in throughout our lives. So may he be a Melitz Yosher for his family, for the yeshiva, and for all of Klal Yisrael.